Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today we are exploring the impact that warfare and the military have had on music history. This comes in various forms, through the march-like quality that finds its way into many compositions, or through the number of operas, oratorios, or even instrumental works inspired by specific military figures or heroes of history. Now, as relates to this subject, we have a unique classroom corner for today's program, so let's get into that segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. Today we are discussing the impact the military has had on compositions throughout music history. For this segment, we see a young musician who is working hard to train other musicians in how to honor her country's military veterans. She is a high school student from right here in Oklahoma who started a nonprofit service organization for high school trumpet players, teaching them how to use their musical gifts to honor military veterans. Right now, we are hearing her play what's been called America's National Song of Remembrance, known as Taps. The organization is called Youth Trumpet and Taps Corps, and its mission is to train high school volunteers to perform taps at military veterans' funerals. Please welcome to the program its founder, Katie Pryor. Why don't you start with telling us how old you are, Katie?
I am 15 years old and I'm in the 10th grade.
Okay. And how long have you been playing the trumpet?
I've been playing since I was 9, so 6 years.
Okay. And who have you studied with here in the Oklahoma City area?
I currently study private lessons with Jay Wilkinson from OU.
And he plays in the Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. Now, this organization that you have, it's a unique organization. You're quite young, of course, for founding something like this. Can you just give us an overview of what Youth Trumpet and Taps Corps does?
Yeah, so we are a service organization for high school trumpet players who volunteer to use their musical gifts to serve the veteran community. So our main project is volunteering to sound taps at veterans' funerals because with over 1,500 veteran funerals a day, there are not enough military buglers to attend every funeral. So most veterans receive an audio recording.
So you supply buglers from the high school population.
Yes. Yes.
And so you are basically training them mm-hmm. as to how to do this. So how did the organization come about? What sparked the idea to start this?
Well, to go way back, when I was first learning to play the trumpet when I was 9, my great-grandfather, who was a World War II veteran, was in hospice care, and my family talked about how great it would be if I could sound taps at his funeral. However, he passed away before I could learn the notes, so I didn't get to play taps for him. So 5 years later, when I heard that most veterans received the audio recording, I was really inspired to do something about it because I've been playing for a lot longer, I could play taps now, and I know a lot of trumpet players that could help me. So
great. And then you started this in what year exactly?
I started it last year.
Last year. So you've been doing this for about a year. And what are some of the specific ways that you've been training these peers of yours, these trumpet players?
At my trainings, it's split into three parts mainly because I've held trainings in Texas and Wisconsin. The first part of the training is really about playing taps because a lot of times the way students play taps in band performances is a little bit different than we would play it at funerals, and I was actually told that when I first did my Oklahoma training. I had a bugler from the 145th Army Band come, and the first thing he said when I played taps for him was, that middle section isn't played quite like that. So one of the biggest things is that the natural, like, the pattern we usually think of when we think of taps, the dun-da-da, isn't, it's all straight eighth notes in the middle, whole middle passage. So that's one thing that we have to really drill into the students' heads, because it's one of the most important things about taps.
So a mentor or someone who'd been doing this for a while mm-hmm. told you, well, there's a slightly different convention when it comes to an actual veteran's funeral. Mm-hmm. And so your mission now is to basically pass along those nuances
yeah.
to fellow trumpeters?
Yeah, and it's also, taps is kind of tricky just because it doesn't look as hard as it is. So really in the beginning of the training, we try to break down all the barriers because it is stressful. Even if like it's some kids from the same school, it can be stressful even then playing in front of kids from the school, or even more in a funeral when it's a solo, when you're the only one up there and the cue may be kind of vague. So we really try at the training to prepare them for that in any way possible. So we invite a local volunteer rifle team, and we give the students each the opportunity to play taps after that rifle's fired, because a lot of times it's a little bit of a shock when you're at your first funeral and you're not used to hearing the rifle fired right behind your head. It can be kind of strange, so we really want to prepare them for that.
So you're preparing them not just how to play something musically, you know, here's the way we do it at this passage, but you're also preparing them for the context of what's happening around them, the noise from the rifle shots. And then also, I imagine, just even the sobriety of the situation itself. That's unlike any musical performance when everyone's there really in a very sober, really mournful mood, and you have to play amidst that. Does some of it have to do with those like emotional barriers as well?
Yeah, definitely. I know. I mean, there have been a lot of funerals I've played at where I've come into the car, I've been completely fine, and I go into the car and I start crying. It's just like, it's such an emotional moment. And being there when you are playing that last salute for that veteran, it's an amazing experience, but it's also, it's really emotional.
So you're preparing these peers of yours for how to do that, both musically, emotionally, procedurally. This is how it works. You said that you've trained students all over the country. You mentioned a couple places. Where has this organization taken you just in the last year?
Well, when we started out the organization, which was I guess it was about a year and a half ago, because I held my first training in 2014, late. Okay. I held it in Texas, and I started out with 9 volunteers in Oklahoma and one friend that came up from Texas. So we started out with just those 10 volunteers in barely 2 states. And that last year, we played 42 community events and 11 funerals. And at this end of the year time, we now have 50 volunteers in 10 states.
Wow. That must be really inspiring to you just as a 15-year-old that you're impacting all these players in that regard. Have you received any feedback from, say, the families of the veterans or any sort of feedback that way?
Yeah, it's just been amazing seeing all the support I've gotten just from, I mean, I've had a lot of news stories done about me. I've been reached out, lots of veterans telling me how amazing it is to see someone from this new generation when it seems kind of like things aren't going to be so great in the future. Seeing someone that young actually carry on and care about the veterans. And it's neat to see how thankful people are.
Awesome. So you said it's taken you to Texas. You mentioned Wisconsin as well. Any other places that you've been to with this training?
Those are the only places I have trained so far. The rest of the students were actually found out about us through some of the news stories or through Facebook, and they all signed up on their own accord. So that's been really neat to see, especially in places where I haven't really instigated anything. It's just been people hearing about it and wanting to do it.
That's great. So now you're thinking ahead, I'm sure, like, where can this take us? What are some of the future goals that you have for this organization? Some of the places you'd like to go, some of the things you'd like to accomplish that you haven't yet. Just share with us some of that insight.
Well, I'm hoping to hold 2 more trainings this year. I'm looking to doing Tulsa and maybe somewhere else in the country. But it's a little bit hard because currently there are only 4 states in the U.S., that excuse students from school when they play taps, and those are Texas, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, and I want to say it's West Virginia. And so it's really hard for students outside of those states to get excused, especially when most funerals are during weekdays, and it's hard to miss school for that. But considering how much we've grown just this year, I think we can really grow a lot more. And I really would like to someday have students in all the 50 states, because this is a problem that exists everywhere.
Right. So your expansion ideas are basically just train more people. That's basically, let's get to as many states as we possibly can. Well, that's great. Well, thanks very much, Katie, for your time. Thanks for talking with us and sharing that with us. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music and the Military, and we are exploring the impact of warfare and the military on music history. We have discussed this military impact as existed in the Baroque, classical, and Romantic eras of music history. Now let's discuss the 20th century, or the so-called modern era, an era that contains two conflicts that were dubbed world wars. Now, composers in this era didn't always write music as inspired by warfare or the military. Sometimes it was more in protest of the idea. Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, for example, a choral orchestral work, was written as a means of warning future generations against taking up arms. Britten dedicated this work to four of his friends who were killed during World War I. World War I also had a unique impact on music history, as it prompted a particular piece by the French composer Maurice Ravel. Ravel was commissioned by an Austrian pianist, Paul Wittgenstein, who lost his right arm in World War I. This 19-minute concerto is in two sections that blend one right into the next, not in the traditional three separate movement format. And we're going to hear what's commonly referred to as the second movement, or you could say the second half at least. So this is Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand. Here is Jean-Yves Thibaudet playing with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Charles Dutoit. Thank you. That was pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet and the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit, playing the second movement, or the second half, of Maurice Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand, a piece written specifically for a veteran of World War I, a pianist who had lost his arm in that conflict. The one-armed pianist who commissioned that was Paul Wittgenstein, and he had also commissioned other composers to write him left-handed-only works. So if you're interested, Sergei Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 4 is also for the left hand and was commissioned by Wittgenstein. So this is a very specific case of a piece of music that was inspired by warfare, you could say, or more properly, the effects of warfare. And we are talking about the impact of the military and warfare in general on the history of mainly fine art music. That was an example from World War I. An example from World War II history is worth mentioning here as well. Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich wrote his Seventh Symphony during the 900-day siege of Leningrad, which began on June 22, 1941, and claimed the lives of more than 600,000 people. Early in July of 1941, just a couple weeks after the siege began, Shostakovich found himself stirred to write this massive work, which has a length of about an hour and 20 minutes. Shostakovich wrote this: "Neither savage raids, German planes, nor the grim atmosphere of the beleaguered city could hinder the flow. I worked with inhuman intensity I have never before reached." After 1 month of enduring terrible conditions in the city, Shostakovich agreed to evacuate to Moscow, then again to the temporary capital of Kubishev on the River Volga. He finished the symphony that December. He titled his Symphony No. 7 Leningrad, and it became known as the Leningrad Symphony. Its first performance took place during the siege on March 5, 1942, and it was a particularly moving experience. The audience consisted of party leaders, military personnel, and civilians. Loudspeakers were installed outside of the hall, allowing other civilians and even German forces to hear the concert. It was also broadcast live over the radio. The musicians who performed the work were dressed in multiple layers to prevent themselves from shivering due to starvation and exhaustion. It is said that this original performance was of poor artistic quality, but highly emotional because of the condition of its musicians. When many had faltered due to exhaustion, the audience stood up as an act of support and encouragement to keep going. The work was seen as a musical biography of the suffering city and could even be considered a tactical strike against German morale, as one music critic put it. One German soldier was quoted saying, "Who are we bombing? We will never be able to take Leningrad because the people here are selfless." The performance received an hour-long standing ovation from an emotionally impacted, tearful audience. A moment ago, I was playing you a portion of the opening of this epic symphony, but let's hear the last several minutes of the final movement. Here it is, performed by the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vasily Petrenko. That was Music for Life. And you are listening to Music for Life on KPCG. Vasily Petrenko conducted the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra in that recording of Dmitri Shostakovich's epic 1 hour, 20-minute long 7th Symphony, known as the Leningrad Symphony. We heard the closing minutes of the final movement. This symphony was inspired by and composed during the 900-day siege of Leningrad, which occurred in World War II. Its debut performance took place during that time as well, when the starving, half-dead orchestra played the music over the loudspeakers as an act of defiance against the Germans. We are exploring music inspired by warfare or the military, or impacted by it, I could say. This is a unique example from the modern era that we just heard, specifically World War II history. We saw another example from World War I history, a piano piece being written for an amputee injured in that war. But the most traditional way that warfare and the military have impacted music history, as we've been discussing throughout this program, is in the number of marches that have been composed. This is particularly the case in any opera, oratorio, or similar musical stage production. If there is a warfare or military component, that inspires this particular kind of rhythmic composition from the composer, as we saw back even in the Baroque era, in the specific case of G.F. Handel. A modern manifestation of this can be found in film scores. If there is a militaristic component to the story, even if the military supposedly existed a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, the composer will evoke a militaristic sound ideal through the use of a march. So here is Imperial March from The Empire Strikes Back, the film score by John Williams. That was the Imperial March from the film score The Empire Strikes Back, composed by John Williams and conducted in that recording by the composer at the helm of the London Symphony Orchestra. And that was music written to depict a fictional army, but nonetheless a militaristic component in music. Now let's get into our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. Recently here at Armstrong Auditorium, we experienced a stirring performance from two contingents of Queen Elizabeth II's military bands. I was able to sit down with the leader of one of those regiments, Mike Robinson, bandmaster of the Band of Royal Marines. How is one appointed as the bandmaster for this ensemble?
Well, my title is actually Warrant Officer Second Class Bandmaster, which is my rank, but also within that, the bandmaster's position is appointed because warrant officers within the Royal Marines Band Service move from administrative posts to the musical posts. So I've actually been in post now since March of last year. This is my first appointment as a bandmaster of a band. My previous job was an administration role. To become a bandmaster, you join the Royal Marines from an early age. I actually joined at 16 and have gone through the ranks. Upon reaching sergeant, you then do a one-year education course studying all aspects of composing, conducting, arranging, musical theory, harmony. So it's quite an intense year. It actually counts towards 2 years of a degree course. Mm. So it's quite intense. But then after that, gain further experience and then eventually get promoted to warrant officer. And then once you've done, initially, you normally get a two-year appointment in an admin role. And then luckily, you get a band after that.
Wow. So you have varying degrees of administrative or general duties that have that are little related to music, and then some musical duties. And what's maybe the division of those duties?
Yeah, within the band structure, we have a Royal Marines captain, Captain Daryl Powell, who's our director of music. So he leads the band and I'm his second in command. Within that, I have to look after all the administration. So I look at the engagements, what ensembles we need, plan all those, task the ensembles with the assistance of my senior NCOs, my sergeants and colour sergeants. And we look at the general day-to-day running of the band to leave the director of music to get on and work his magic with the band. But saying that, I also then have a secondary role of conducting the band alongside the director of music. So
you do a fair bit of conducting.
Yeah. It's we share it probably 40-60.
I see. So. And so you, as a musician, you have instruments that you play. I'm sure as a bandmaster, you have several that you're versatile in.
Yeah,
is that correct? Which ones would those be?
When I initially joined, I trained as a bass player. So I was a tuba player before I joined. Then we have a 3-year training program. Within that 3 years training, we teach all of our musicians an orchestral instrument as well as a military band instrument. So the Royal Marines Band Service, we can perform as not just on the marching platform, but also as a concert band, a symphonic orchestra, function band, all small ensembles, wind ensembles, brass ensembles. So we're quite versatile. But with myself, I learned the tuba, but then was also taught the double bass and the bass guitar.
Hmm. Okay, so the bass functioning instruments.
Yeah.
And so that gives you some commonality among your different instruments.
That's right, yeah. Everybody is put into a certain instrument category. All our clarinet players play either violin or viola. Same with our cornet players. Our euphonium players play cello. We have certain instruments. Trombone is a solo instrument and French horn. And we also have specialists on clarinet and trumpet as well.
And when you perform with the band, what will you be doing on stage?
Generally now my role is conducting only. I don't tend to need to play because my position takes me away from the instrumental side of things. I only now tend to play for fun.
Okay. And where has this position, you know, as bandmaster using the colloquial, I guess, where has that taken you throughout the world?
Well, in my service, I've done 7 months on board one of Her Majesty's ships, HMS Illustrious, travelled from Portsmouth in England, travelled all the way through the Mediterranean, through the Suez Canal, India, Singapore, and went down to Australia. So that was quite an eventful trip back in 1997. But as a leader, I've taken ensembles to Japan, to the Ascension Islands. But ultimately, this is my first big trip as a military leader.
Great. And this band, I mean, obviously it's well received worldwide. And certainly, I think one thing that sets it apart is its versatility. Like you were talking about that, just the different kinds of music you have to perform. Talk about what sets this particular ensemble apart from other military bands in the world.
The Royal Marines itself, whether it be the band service or the commandos, we strive for excellence in everything we do. And that's ultimately what we do every day. Plus, we have this rigorous training program, which gives people a great foundation of 3 years, because within the School of Music, we have military instructors who are there on hand day to day. And also we have civilian professors who play for a lot of the top London orchestras, some for the BBC Big Band, and they're really great musicians. So our guys have a real good foundation, and we carry that through in our daily training. We work every day 9 till 4 to rehearse, and then the guys also practice, continue to get lessons throughout their career. So we're always pushing, we're always striving for that excellence.
Wow, that's fantastic. And you, when did you get into music yourself?
Well, I played euphonium for about a year at the age of 9, and then
okay,
I graduated to the tuba, I like to say.
And so that training, like you said, you're using more versatility of all these other different things that you've learned since then. And you've described the theoretical training and just the intensive, more music major type thing that we might call it in the United States,
That
type of thing. What's interesting, I think, also, like you're talking about this philosophy of striving for excellence, that's certainly a military concept, but also a musical one. And just thinking about this interesting combination of soldier-musician, I'm curious to know, as a musician, how your place in the military affects the artistic decisions you make. I mean, what makes a musician in a band like this different from other musicians? Or what kind of decisions are you making with that perspective of this job you have?
I guess we all work with it in different ways. But one thing that does kind of help is the military discipline makes you, focus more, work really hard, and direct your energy wherever it may be. Although we do work military in a lot of respects, we've got guys in the band who've deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, and more recently, we've got about 8 guys who were deployed off the west coast of Africa to Sierra Leone to the Ebola crisis. But no matter what we do, I think it's the combination of the discipline and the music works so well together. But then whenever we requested to do anything else, be it military or aid-wise, because our guys are so focused and have that determination, they can turn their hand to anything quite easily.
That's fantastic. Well, Mike Robinson, thank you so very much for your time. I appreciate you taking time out of a busy day just before this performance. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music and the Military, and we are exploring the impact of warfare and the military on music history. You can find out more about our program by following us on Twitter at MusicForLifePCG or going to Facebook.com/MusicForLifePCG. Finally, let's have our dessert for today's program, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the episode. As a contrast to all the marches and other compositions we've heard that have been impacted by warfare, I want to play a vocal piece produced here by the Philadelphia Church of God that is based on the idea of war implements being converted into agricultural implements. This is a poem by Amy Hallett based on the verse in Isaiah 2 that speaks of a time when men will beat their swords into plowshares. This poem, set to music by Joel Hilliker, considers a time when the sword will be so obsolete that a child might not even know what it is. Enjoy, members of the Philadelphia Singers of the Philadelphia Church of God, performing Plowshare.
The sun rose from the east, repenting westward flight, as it chased away the night, and saw the rose bloom and rivers roll across the land, a treasure rising from the sand. It used to be a dry land, where men cry. resting underneath his Concord vine, savors labors of his hand.
He hears singing from the mountain, songs of praise before the Lord, as he walks behind the plowshare that used to be a sword.
A small child follows in his footprints on the ground. He smiles as he turns around. He can, he teaches his son wrong from right, that which is pleasing in God's sight. The child deeply loves his father and the lessons of the Lord. Oh, the sun rose from the east, repenting westward flight, as it chased away the night. And all was pleasing in God's sight.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.